You're listening to the Going Native segment of the Zesty Garden. In studio with me is Barney Barnett, who's co-owner of Willard Bay Gardens in Willard. And the first plant that we're going to look at in our series is that, I don't know my Latin very well, pulsatilla?
Typically, it's a pulsatilla,
okay.
Even though LL is a Y in some languages, but in Latin and Greek, it's still an L.
Okay, pulsatilla. So some of these, yeah, I had to look up because I wasn't familiar with their Latin. And in this case, it's the pasque flower.
Pasque flower is a common name. Pulsatilla is grown across the Northern Hemisphere, so you'll find species in Europe and you'll find species in North America, both. Not the same species necessarily, but different species in both places.
And did I read somewhere that this is a native to the U.S.?
There are some species native in North America, United States, even up into Canada as well. It is a really fun plant. I like it. It's in my stable, so to speak, of my favorites of water wise and plants that can handle a little bit adverse conditions.
Now, this is one that, as I was reading about it, I thought would be fun to have in my early season garden, because is it kind of like a bulb that way?
It blooms bulb time.
Yeah.
I won't say bulb-like, but bulb time. March, April is when it blooms.
Oh, so quite early.
So it's quite early and quite striking. The flowers are quite noticeable early, very unique flower. The foliage is less noticed early, and then the foliage and flower both you'll see by April. And then what's exceptionally nice about this plant is the seed head will come on in May. So you'll have March, April, flower, foliage, then seed head. And so it's quite unique and quite fun.
So what does the seed head look like?
Seed head looks like that ancient thing that Europeans used to swing over their head that had a ball with spikes on it. What is that thing called?
Oh, a mace?
Is that what that's called?
Is that a mace?
I don't know. But that's what the seed head looks
like.
Oh,
okay. So
it's very, very spiky, hairy-like, and just really as fun as the flower.
And what colors?
Flower colors on pulsatillas will be typically blue-purple, but you'll also find pink or burgundy or white, depending on the species or cultivar.
And how tall does it get?
12 or 15 inches tall, 12 or 15 inches wide at a maturity 2 or 3 years.
And where would you put it in your garden?
It's going to like it sunny. Part sunny would be its two favorite places. Part shady is okay, but not full shade. And because of when it blooms, you're not going to have many leaves on trees anyway, so that may change, you know, where you could put it. Of course, you'll want it to survive through the summer, so I wouldn't put it in deep shade because maybe it's not as happy. So part sun. And the species that are native in the U.S. are prairie natives rather than desert or mountain natives. And so it'll take some drought because the prairies will get water periodically, but not all the time. So it'll take some drought, but it's okay to be watered as well.
Okay, so it won't rot with a little bit of overwatering.
It will not rot with a little bit of overwatering. It can handle some watering, and in it could be in a regular garden, or it can be in a water-wise garden. Either one and be fine.
And how does it propagate?
It's seed, and it will send seed, and you will actually find seedlings in your garden. And there are some plants that we find seedlings in our gardens, and we go, ugh, it's seeding around. This plant seeds around, and you go, ooh, it's seeding around. it's that lovely. It's that fun. It's that lovely.
So is this something that you could use as a ground cover?
It's clumping. So it has a clumping effect. And even though it seeds, it's still going to be clumping. It won't really be that full and mat forming, even though it's seeded. It'll be clumps hither and yon.
And what type of soil should it be grown in?
It will not care about the soil because many of the prairies are heavy clay. Many of the prairies are sandy. So it's adaptable soil-wise to either. And if you're a good gardener and you're putting organic in your gardens, it'll be happy with some organic too.
And what zone does this grow down to?
Most pulsatillas are probably threes, zone three, zone four, zone five, easily. So it's quite cold tolerant.
Very adaptable. And what about warmer climes?
I would think you wouldn't want to go beyond seven. I think it'd be 3 to 7, 4 to 7, in that range. I think when you get hotter, it's not going to be as happy. So it'd be ideal for a Cache Valley location, northern Utah, southern Idaho. Ideal for any of us in this area.
Okay. And wildlife, do the deer like to eat it, or does it attract
That's
insects?
A great question. Because of when it blooms, it's earlier than most insects are out doing their thing. And I don't know about the deer. Deer are out and about in March and April yet. They haven't gone into hiding. So that's a question I can't answer, Brian.
I'll plant some in my tulips and tell you exactly
okay,
what happens.
Okay, very good.
Great. Well, you've been listening to Going Native. It's our segment talking about drought-tolerant and native plants. And my guest in studio has been Barney Barnett. He's co-owner of Willard Bay Gardens in Willard. And we've been talking about the Pasc flower, or pulsatilla. Thank
Correct.
You very much.
Thank you, Brian.
I have with me on the line today Sarah Albee. She's author of Bugged, How Insects Changed History. And it answers some of the following questions, like how did insects lead to the Louisiana Purchase? How have bugs killed more soldiers than weapons have? Is silk really made from caterpillar spit? Were British soldiers' redcoats dyed with smushed bugs? And how do insects help detectives solve murder mysteries? Sarah, thank you for joining me on today's Zesty Garden.
Hi, Brian. Happy to be here.
I'm just curious. So where did the idea come from to make this book?
Well, I should quickly say it's a book for kids of middle school age and older. The predecessor to this book is called, it's about the history of toilets and sanitation, and it's called Poop Happened, A History of the World from the Bottom Up. And while I was writing that book, which came out in 2010, there's a whole chapter in it about insect-vectored diseases, diseases that are transmitted by insects, which, of course, do occur in places where filthy streets and people can't keep themselves clean and medieval times and history. And so as I was writing the poop book, I was thinking, I have a whole chapter on bugs. I could write a whole book about bugs. And that's how that began, that idea formed. And so it's really, there. A lot of the book is about the terrible diseases that have been vectored by insects, like typhus and plague and cholera and yellow fever and malaria. But there's also a lot about beneficial bugs.
Well, and why don't you talk a little bit about how the book is laid out? Because it is a larger book, larger font, a lot of pictures. In fact, as an adult, I appreciate being able to have this information. You have different things like an insecticide, A-S-I-D-E, in here that has a little more in-depth information about that particular topic.
Right. I like to think of my books as kind of a mashup between science and history. And it really is primarily, I would say, a history book in that it traces human civilization from ancient times to the present. And for me, I really think chronology is a really important part of the structure of my books because I really want kids and adults to get a sense of the chronology of history. I mean, when I was a kid, learning in school, we would have a unit on ancient Greece or a unit on the American Revolution, and I didn't really have a good sense of the chronology of what happened first and what happened next. So that's the way the book is structured. But what I like to do is find a theme and that I think is appealing to kids, and trace that theme through history. So of course, with toilets and sanitation, that was the poop book, and then with the bug book, it's insects. And my forthcoming book in February is going to be the history of crazy fashions and what people wore and why. So I like to think of these themes as appealing to kids, and it will sort of get them excited about history.
It sounds like this is a fun process for you to write these.
It's really fun. I keep complaining to everyone who will listen that I keep writing the same book over and over again, which is the history of the whole wide world, which is a bit of a daunting prospect. but it's fun because I feel like I can talk about events in history that other writers aren't able to. For example, I think you mentioned the Lewis and Clark in the intro. They were exploring the American West in 1803, and Thomas Jefferson was in the White House, and over in France, Napoleon is about to make himself emperor, and in Germany, Beethoven is composing his first symphony. And so I can talk about all those things if I can relate them to my theme, which I manage to do most of the time.
Now, there is a little bit of insight, for me there was anyway, of you producing this book and how it must be in your regular life with your family, because in the acknowledgments you say, "For John, Sam, Cassie, and Luke, sorry about all the bug talk at the dinner table."
Yeah, that would be my husband and my three kids. I guess my kids are used to their mother by now. They would get a stricken look on their face when I, you know, talk about things at the dinner table, especially with the poop book, but of course the insect book too. I think I do have the mind of an 11 or 12 year old kid. I find it fascinating, and icky stuff is cool, and they're nice about it, but they're used to me by now.
But are they giving you valuable feedback as you bring something up?
Absolutely, and I really. What I love to do more than anything, except write, is visit schools and talk to real live kids and bounce ideas off of them. And I do lots and lots of author visits, and middle school kids are kind of the sweet spot for me. They're challenging because, you know, they're growing up and they're I think if you can sort of win them over early on, they're just so fun, and they love to laugh. And they're interested in a lot of things. And I definitely have bounced ideas off my own children. But now that they're getting older, I continue to do so every time I go to a school. So, and I do a lot of Skype visits as well.
Well, I'd love to have you come to Utah sometime. I might have to put a bug in the ear of our science teacher where my son's going to school. Okay, but let's just dive into this. So what is a bug? And in the preface, you say, "Even if you're a person who doesn't like bugs, you have to admit that it isn't fair to say a bug is good or bad. A hungry flea is just trying to get a bite to eat. A stinging bee is just trying to defend her home from invaders. And a dung beetle rolling a ball of poop is just trying to make a living."
I happen to love bugs. And I should also say I use the term bug, which isn't exactly accurate. It should be insects. There are bugs that are a type of insect, but I think in the vernacular people say bugs. So I say that in the preface, that we're going to call them bugs, whether they're actual bugs or not. I happen to love insects and always have. Ever since I was a little kid, I loved them. I examined them. I caught bees in a jar. I always let them go. But I was just fascinated by them. But I do appreciate that not everyone does love them. And so my goal is at least to have people respect insects, if nothing else. And they really are miraculous creatures. They have done so much. I mean, they've been around since the Paleozoic era, which is about 400 million years. And we've only been around for about 120,000 years. So they are survivalists, and They are able to evolve very quickly, and it's kind of a I guess the premise of the book is that we can't get rid of them whether we want to or not, and we need to learn to coexist with them.
Well, and you also wrote that for every pound of us, there are 300 pounds of insects.
That's right, and most of them leave us alone or are indifferent to us. It's the bad ones, the bad, I use that in quotation marks because they're not really bad, but the insects that have caused the most misery to humans, I have four in my rogues gallery. There's the fly, the flea, the mosquito, and the louse. Flies can transmit many, many, many different diseases. The mosquito, two types. One transmits malaria, another yellow fever. The body louse transmits typhus, and the flea transmits bubonic plague. So those are the ones that have really caused the most misery in human history. But people didn't realize that it was bug, I should say. Yeah. They didn't realize that these diseases were transmitted by bugs. Not until the very end of the 19th century did people discover that that was the case.
So we're talking just barely over 100 years ago.
I know. It's amazing. Well, with Pasteur and germ theory, part of it was they didn't have powerful enough microscopes to be able to see under the microscope, to see these germs and protists under a microscope. But people, you know, in days of yore, believed that diseases were caused by bad air most of the time. Malaria means bad air in Italian. Or they thought it was by touch. So anyone who had a disease was quarantined if it was possible to. That's why many of the plague victims in the 14th century didn't necessarily die of plague. Many of them died of starvation because their houses would get boarded up. If there was someone fell victim to plague in a household, the inhabitants would all be boarded up inside. There's a lot of grimness in this book, I have to say.
You have an illustration that shows someone in an upper story window with a noose trying to hang the minder out front that keeps people from going into the house because the people inside the house were probably starving.
Yeah, that is supposedly a true story. It's always difficult to know from, you know, hundreds of years ago if these facts are actual facts. So I did have to say one story goes, but that evidently did happen. But I must say Robert Layton, who did the illustrations for the book, was a genius with finding humor in some pretty dark tales. But, you know, he managed to do that. So I'm very grateful to him.
So what is an insect? What exactly is an insect?
An insect is, it has six legs. It's got an exoskeleton. It's an invertebrate, meaning it has no bones inside its body. And at some point in its life, it has a head, thorax, and an abdomen. So it's segmented in three places. Of course, kids all point out, well, a caterpillar doesn't have a head, thorax, and abdomen. So I had to qualify that. That's the beauty of going to schools and talking to kids, because at some point in its life, a caterpillar does develop into an insect with three segments. So there are arthropods, which is sort of the higher order to which insects all belong, and ticks and mites are arthropods, but they are not insects. Well, there's no Lyme disease in this book because that's transmitted by ticks.
I wanted to make sure that I opened this up. If any of our listeners have any questions or comments, this is a live interview, and the toll-free number is 1-800-826-1495. That's 800-826-1495. Or you can send us an email question. It's zestygarden@gmail.com. I'm talking with Sarah Albee, who's author of Bugged, How Insects Changed History. I love how you've written and made this very acceptable for all people, but especially for kids. Like if I was reading this book to my son, he would really get into it because of the way that you've worded things, such as when you talk about the insects, that they're invertebrates. So that's why they go crunch when you step on them, because of their exoskeletons.
Right, exactly. Well, thank you. I appreciate that. It is, I mean, you know, history isn't always a barrel of laughs, and I don't mean to trivialize many thousands of years of human suffering, but it is, I think, kids do like humor, and my mission is to get them to love history. So I do try to find approaches that, if they're not thigh-flappingly hilarious, at least they're gross, and kids find that fun too. Again, don't mean to trivialize human suffering, but it is, you know, it is, I do really hope the kids will love history and learn later when they're studying these units in school and they learn about the Roman Empire, maybe they'll remember this book that they read a few years back about how the ancient Romans, how the strain of malaria that they, and Attila the Hun, who tried to conquer the city and left quickly because of disease. I mean, I'm hoping that it'll trigger memories and help them kind of put the events of history into perspective and into chronology.
Well, let's talk about beneficial insects. You have a chapter named The Land of Silk and Honey. And one of the things that jumped out at me here a little bit into the chapter was this section, just a little section on suture self. I had never heard of this before, but just the idea was just like, I don't know if I could stand for the treatment.
Yeah, that one, yeah, there are a few of those, the medicinal use of insects. In certain cultures, in India and also in South America, and I'm not going to try to remember the exact names, but there is, in the rainforest of the Amazonian rainforest, there is a certain kind of species of ant that has very large mandibles. And if you have cut yourself or your friend has cut himself, the ants were used to bite down on either side of the wound, and then the head was twisted off and left in place and acted as a suture. It really doesn't sound like fun. It sounds like it would be horrifically painful and not much fun for the ant either.
Well, and then to look at it, I know there's the illustration is here says it all.
Yeah, it's pretty skeevy for sure. But there are all kinds of things like that in the beneficial bugs chapter. There's another one which is actually still in use today, but using fly maggots to clean wounds was discovered in wartime accidentally. These two soldiers, I believe it was during the Revolutionary War, who were left out with wounds, you know, they weren't retrieved from the battlefield for a while, and they were believed to be at death's door with horrible wounds. And the doctor, when he went to treat them, found that maggots had cleaned out their wounds better than any surgeon's knife could have done, and they recovered. And so that's an amazing, if disgusting, little detail. And actually, doctors are using maggots today, and leeches, too, for that matter.
Well, and looking
I hope I'm not grossing everyone
no,
out.
No, it's just to me that's fascinating. Well, and looking at how over the centuries doctors have treated victims, not knowing what they were doing, and mercury comes up quite a bit. I mean, what they were doing to treat probably caused as many or more deaths than the insects.
Absolutely. In fact, generally speaking, the richer you were, the worse off you were by your doctor's treatment. And some kings and famous, George Washington is another example, were probably hastened to an earlier death by their doctors than poor people who couldn't afford doctors and pretty much, you know, let luck take its course.
So what did I read about George Washington?
Sorry, interrupted you.
I know, I did. I was just going to ask you back up George Washington. I read something about him being bloodletted, and it's like half his blood was probably taken out.
Yeah, the poor man. I mean, yeah, he was ministered to by many doctors who were well-meaning, but it was not, it was pretty sad. Yeah, they bled him, which was a common treatment for hundreds and hundreds of years. It goes back to the ancient physician Galen, who had the four humors and thought that if there was an excess of whatever humor in your body, you should have less of it. So bleeding was a very common treatment for disease. Another one that's insect-related was cantharidin, which is a kind of beetle, a blister beetle. And these would be dried and smushed up and powdered and mixed into paste. And you read about blister poultices that sick people had to have put on them. poor George Washington had blister poultices, and it was this ground up beetle that would raise blisters as though you'd been burned. It was horrible. Mm. But yeah, he suffered greatly from his treatment. And King Charles II in England was another poor man with about 17 physicians who did all kinds of things like that, taking blood and enemas and emetics and you name it, blister beetles. That was common.
Well, we're going to take a quick break and then be back. I'm talking with Sarah Albee, author of Bugged, How Insects Changed History. And specifically, when we come back, I want to talk about the color red and how crushed beetles have provided that color. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the second half of The Zesty Garden. I'm your host, Brian Earle, and with me on the line is Sarah Albee, author of Bugged, How Insects Changed History. And if you'd like to join our conversation, the toll-free number is 1-800-826-1495, or send us an email question. It's zestygarden@gmail.com. We have about 15 minutes left in the program. So what is it about the color red? How does that involve insects?
Well, for hundreds of years, European dyers were trying to get a good red dye, and it was very, very difficult. They tried everything. They tried blood and leaves, and they did find a kind of a plant root called madder, that M-A-D-D-E-R, that achieved a pretty good kind of brick red. But they really hadn't found a perfect red color until the Spanish conquistador, Hernando Cortez, encountered the Aztecs in what is now Mexico. And he saw, when he first saw Montezuma, who was the emperor of the Aztecs, he was amazed that Montezuma and his courtiers were wearing these brilliantly colored red robes. And the Spanish, they figured out, or they ended up seizing the secret from the Aztecs, which was this scale insect called the cochineal. The Latin, I think, is Dactylopius coccus, with apologies if I got the Latin pronunciation wrong. And what it's this kind of insect that has no arms and legs. It doesn't even look like an insect. It kind of looks like a white, fuzzy fungus, but it lives on a certain kind of cactus in that part of the world, and it was scraped off and smushed, and out came a red dye. And so the Spaniards took the secret from the Aztecs, and they built an empire with the color red. Nobody could figure out how they were doing it, and they really became a world power because of this red. And you would see, you know, the cardinal's robes and British red coats. That was all dyed with the color, this kind of cochineal beetle, not a beetle, sorry, a cochineal scale insect. And it wasn't until synthetic dyes were developed in the late 1800s that the cochineal was not used much, although it is still in use today. In fact, it's used to dye some foodstuffs as well.
So what do you look for on the label?
Well, it's difficult. I mean, it's FDA approved, so sometimes you don't know. It's not going to say, oh, there's scale insects in your yogurt. But yeah, no, a lot of the red natural coloring, quote unquote, is made from cochineal. But, we eat a lot worse things than that. So
I often wonder, well, who's the first person who says, what will happen if I scrape this insect off and crush it?
You do wonder that. Although I think in this case, it was fairly logical, because these insects, because they don't have arms and legs, are, of course, very vulnerable to predators. And this red, maybe it's, I'm not sure if it's poisonous to birds, but when you smush it, the red stuff comes right out. And red in nature tends to be a bad idea, and I think a lot of predators have learned that. So I think it is kind of a ward-off predators kind of thing. And I think the first human who might have smushed one of these bugs by accident would have seen that. I have a picture in the book. Sadly, it's not in full color, but the actual picture you see, it really does look like blood has come out, which is this red dye. It's quite remarkable, really. And then it's a whole intrigue. I mean, finally someone stole the secret from the Spaniards, and, you know, the pirates, the English and the Spanish were at war with one another in the 1500s, and they were constantly seizing one another's ships, and they eventually stole the secret, and the world learned how this happened, how this came about, this color.
Well, I want to dive into the rest of the book as well, because so much is about the history of insects, human hygiene, how one affects the other. We have about 9 minutes left in the program, so let's move right on into that. So talk about your chapter two is the horrible history of human hygiene.
Yeah.
And it's really sad considering how many people have died.
Yeah, well, I mean, many of these insect vector diseases occur in places where hygiene is not good. Bubonic plague is a classic example. There's the black rat has a kind of flea that feeds on the rats and transmits bubonic plague. And where there is garbage and filth in the streets, there tends to be rats. One of the major pandemics was in 1348, but plague occurred on and off for many centuries, and that was transmitted in times when hygiene was not a high priority. And then typhus is another classic example. It's transmitted by the body louse, and it tends to occur in places where people are unable to keep themselves clean. Sadly, in places like concentration camps, but also on ships, in jails. It was called jail fever. And what it is, the body louse will, it's not the bite of the louse, it's the excrement of the louse, which can be teeny tiny, but that will get blown into the air, and if it just enters a wound, that can transmit typhus quite easily. Or if you just scratch your skin, you can scratch the toxins right into yourself. And so typhus has mown down so many millions of people through history. A big example is Napoleon's army in Russia. As they were marching through Russia in 1812, he started out with 500,000 soldiers. And by the time they got to Moscow, I think there were 100,000 left. And so many of them died, not just from starvation and exposure, but from typhus. That was a very terrible scourge on Napoleon's troops.
And then he went back and got more soldiers, and the same thing happened again.
That's right. He re-upped with another 500,000. It's kind of mind-boggling when you think of the numbers and the dead. It's really tragic. But again, they did not know in 1812 that the louse was the vector of the disease. Although, frankly, if they had known, there's not much they could have done. I mean, even after people realized by the late 1800s that certain, like for example, that the flea was the vector of bubonic plague, there wasn't much they could do. I mean, I explain this to kids when I go to schools. Like, it's not like what they tell us nowadays is, oh, wear long pants and spray yourself with bug spray. There wasn't such a thing as bug spray. So even after they knew that, for example, mosquitoes caused malaria, it was very difficult to protect yourself anyway until we start. I mean, actually, the Panama Canal, I know I'm jumping around like crazy in history, but the Reed Commission in Havana, Walter Reed and his team figured out that mosquitoes were vectors of yellow fever. And then later, a few years later, with the Panama Canal, the Americans drained swamps and did all kinds of mosquito prevention measures and managed to get the Panama Canal built because they managed to get rid of most of the mosquitoes that vector malaria and yellow fever.
And related to that, I read about where the Spanish priests during the 1600s that were in Peru noticed that the local Incas possessed a miraculous medicine for fevers and chills that helped them stand malaria.
That's
and
right.
Even took care of it.
That's right. It's called cinchona, and it's a bark, and it's a bark of a certain tree that, yes, the Spanish priests discovered from the Incas in the 1600s, and for several hundred years, the bark was the only known treatment for malaria and also the only known prevention of malaria. It could lower the fever and it could prevent you from getting it. And it was incredibly bitter tasting. And they would powder it and put it into wine or whatever. But it was distrusted because it was called the Jesuit's powder. It was distrusted in the very Protestant England of the 1600s. As a result, a lot of people died who didn't take cinchona. Like Oliver Cromwell was supposedly, he supposedly died of malaria. The cinchona was eventually, they figured out how to synthesize it into quinine. And that is what cinchona bark is. And in fact, the British in India, the soldiers, when British occupied India for much of the 19th century, the British took daily doses of quinine, and they added some gin and a little lime, and that was the gin and tonic. It was really an anti-malarial drink, the gin and tonic. I actually tasted it. I'd read about cinchona being terribly bitter tasting, and I was really, really wanting to taste it. And I found some in a store in New York City. This funny store had a packet of cinchona bark, and I took it home and I ground it up and I tasted it, and it was really, really bitter. I feel so. I now understand what people had to deal with.
So what does it do to your mouth when you put it in your mouth?
At first, when you put it in your mouth, you think, okay, it just tastes like I'm eating pencil shavings. But quite quickly, the sensation of this is a terribly bitter sensation, spit it out, but it's too late. And then you just have to run and have a Jolly Rancher or something like that to get the taste out of your mouth.
Counteract it. Why don't you talk about presidential bugs? I thought this was really quite interesting, how many of our U.S. presidents have suffered from insect vector diseases.
Yeah, many. I mean, you'd be amazed how many presidents have had malaria. They didn't die of it, but many of them, George Washington, James Monroe, Andrew Jackson, all the way up to John F. Kennedy, who contracted malaria, I believe, during... would it be World War II or Korea? He contracted malaria and suffered with bouts of it because malaria can kind of come and go over the course of many years. Others, Zachary Taylor had a whole bunch of yellow fever, malaria, maybe even had cholera and typhus. He was a pretty unlucky guy. James Garfield, Theodore Roosevelt also had malaria. Mm-hmm. So they really did suffer from many of these diseases just as everyone else did. But again, I don't believe any of them died of an insect vector disease.
Well,
it's always difficult to know.
In writing this book, do you have a favorite story, something that you can tell the readers that just brings to your mind something that you really enjoyed about the book?
To call it favorite, I really am fascinated by Napoleon. I'm fascinated and horrified by him as a person. And he was kind of at the core of so many different stories in the book. For example, he sold Thomas Jefferson the Western Territory, which was the Louisiana Territory, which expanded our country by a third, mostly because when he was trying to take over Haiti, so many of his soldiers died of yellow fever and malaria, and he just figured, you know, the rest of that northern part, you know, above Haiti is also disease-ridden, and he just thought, you know, I really don't need this. So he sold off a third of our country, you know, what became an extra third of our country because largely partly due to how disease-ridden it was. And then his campaigns in Russia were just horrifying. So he's one that I find quite fascinating. And then the conquistadors in the New World, it's a terribly sad story, but how they conquered a continent not with really so much with guns and horses and things, but because so many of the natives had no immunity to old world diseases, and 90% of the people you know, the people who were living here in our in the New World died of diseases brought over by the Europeans. Again, I wouldn't call that my favorite story, but it's one that I think more kids should learn about in school.
Interesting. Okay.
I think.
Well, I'm sorry we've reached the end of our time. There's so much more to discuss about this book, but I've really enjoyed reading it. This is Bugged, How Insects Changed History, written by Sarah Albee. And Sarah, thanks so much for joining me today on The Zesty Garden.
Oh, thank you. It was fun.
Coming up next is the latest and last for this year edition of Petals and Prose with Nancy Williams.
Good morning. I'm Nancy Williams for the Petals and Prose section of the Zesty Garden. And I want to share some today about seasons in the garden because all of them are, well, okay, three of them are so wonderful. And then we have winter, which is so important. And we all think, what do we do in winter with the garden besides read up on the seed catalogs? But that's an important part. I'm not going to talk to you today about reading the seed catalogs. I'm just going to talk about some of the things we do in some of the seasons that we really love. It actually ends with winter, so I almost couldn't be truthful to my opening statement. This comes from Gardening at the Dragon's Gate by Wendy Johnson, which if you've been listening long, you know is one of my favorite gardening manuals because it has not just instructions, but great little essays. And this is one of her fun little essays. She writes, "Summer is wild berry season on the California coast, the time when the Green Gulch kids migrate to the edge of the high summer garden to build secret blackberry forts. While the grones, as they call us, work harvesting butter lettuce and the last lavender of the season, Zen rascals guzzle ripe berries deep in the maze of summer. The kids do come up out of their blackberry thicket for high tea in the late afternoon. Hot, dirty, and scratched, and indigo blue with blackberry juice, they are hosed off and served iced lemon verbena tea, afloat with sprigs of black mint and anise hyssop blossoms. The garden crew bribes the kids into coming to tea. If they gather us a few baskets of wild blackberries early in the day, we'll make fruit tarts for tea time. We cajole them. No surprise, they agree. High tea is good at the end of a long day of making forts and living outside of Zen law. We all spoil our appetites for dinner with tiny fruit tarts made from wild blackberries mixed with dead ripe gooseberries and the last white currants of the season. After tea, we lie back in the grass and watch the evening clouds mount in the west, out over the ocean. The hills darken, russet and amber, and all the garden cranberry bean plants sag with the weight of August. The kids' parents are probably worried about where they are, but we are too lazy to move or be mildly responsible. Even when the first owls settle on the dark cypress limbs, we fail to budge. Young and old together, we are sated with full summer. But now that's past. In autumn, the ground is thirsty for rain, and by late October, Redwood Creek has dropped underground. Outside of the garden, the coast live oaks and huge tan oaks of the watershed ripen their acorns. The blue jays collect the first acorns of November, drilling them into the dry ground with their sharp beaks. Watching the jays work, I know it's time to begin my own harvest of acorns from oaks on the lower flanks of Mount Tamalpais that have been harvested for generations by the native Costa Noan tribes of the California Bay Area. As recently as 250 years ago, the Ohlone people who lived in the Redwood Creek watershed were hunter-gatherers who also farmed the land, cultivating the wild oaks. Particular oak trees were in the care of individual family groups for generations, in an era when time itself was linked to the seasons of the oak. The autumn harvest, when tribes came together to celebrate by gleaning, gathering, and preparing food harvested from the oaks, marked the new year. Winter was measured in moon phases from the time of the acorn harvest. Spring was told by the flowering of the oaks, and summer was marked by the progression toward the ripening of the acorn harvest. 10,000 native people inhabited the 150 miles from the San Francisco Bay south to the Esalen Nation of Big Sur. The native people tended their trees faithfully. The first drop of acorns was usually riddled with acorn moth larvae. The Ohlone people covered these wormy acorns with dry grass and set the grass afire, destroying the primary larval phase of the oak pest. Then, when the healthy main season acorn drop occurred in early November, the fruit fell on a clean understory of savanna-like parkland beneath the huge oaks. There's an old story told by the Karuk people of Northern California about how the different species of oak came to earth. In the old days, acorns were sky maidens living in the heavens. Once, when there was famine on the earth, the sky maidens took pity and came down to be food. Valley Oak Girl dove down first, clapping her small gathering basket on her long, slender head. Her sister, Black Oak Maiden, wore her large burden basket, which is to this day her signature acorn cap. Next came tiny Coast Live Oak Girl with her small basket cap, and last of all, wearing her messy, rough burden basket cap, Tan Oak Maiden descended, becoming the richest food of all. Gathering acorns was a favorite autumn practice for my daughter and me for many years. I still gather acorns every autumn, and miraculously, my teenage daughter often helps. We take the acorns home, spread the good ones to dry behind our wood-burning stove. After a few days, we crack the acorns using a prized stone pestle. Though a mallet or hand pruners are equally effective, we pry the acorn meat out of the shell. Every season, we begin pounding the acorn meat by hand, but soon move to a modern food processor that whizzes the remainder of the acorn meat into a golden meal. Acorns are bitter in taste, rich in tannin and oil. Native people leached their acorn meal in slow-running river water to wash away the tannic acid. My modern adaptation is simple. I hang the acorn meal in cheesecloth pouches under a slow-dripping cold water tap overnight. Dark ochre tannin colors our old enamel sink a rich butternut gold every November. After it's leached, the acorn meal is laid to dry on clean towels before I toast it slowly in our oven until the kitchen smells like the inner kernel of the sunny oak forest. I mix the roasted meal with honey and fold in some fresh pumpkin pulp, adding whole wheat flour and a little baking soda to raise the bread. Every season, the acorn bread is a little different, depending on whim and fancy and what is at hand. If you want to do this, I was talking with our host of the Zesty Garden, Brian Earle, about where to find acorns. And I think although we don't have any wonderful live oaks or the other oaks that California does, we could still gather acorns from scrub oak in the mountains, and that might work. I would be willing to try it. If I find an acorn patch, I probably will. The basic ingredients for this, which she calls Thanksgiving acorn pumpkin bread, are 1 cup of whole wheat or white flour, 3/4 cup of acorn meal, 1 teaspoon salt, 1 1/4 cups of brown sugar, 2 teaspoons baking soda, and spices to taste. So that would be cinnamon, nutmeg, mace, whatever is your favorite spicy pumpkin bread spice. And for the wet ingredients, you need 1 cup of pumpkin pulp, which you can take from a can, or you can simply bake a small pumpkin, cut it open and scoop out the seeds and just measure pulp out of that. 1/3 cup of vegetable oil, 1/4 cup of water, and 2 eggs beaten. You combine the dry ingredients and you mix them together with the wet ingredients and then fold them in together into a well-oiled baking tin. Bake it at 350 for 50 to 60 minutes. And good luck with that. That's what I'd say. It says enjoy at the end, but I'm thinking it might not be to our taste. Not much lost, just a new learning experience. Wendy continues, I do not bake acorn bread on hot slabs of rock as the Ohlone people did. I am a modern kind of native to this earth, baking in a wolf oven as I keep the links to our watershed alive season after season. In early December, when winter unravels the organized garden, I want all work wound up, but winter's skein of ragged tasks lengthens as the days shorten. By the evening of the winter solstice, darkness drops well before 5 p.m., like iron shears cutting the last threads of the lit year. Yet every December, cold, wet soil calls me out of my warm house. I like to climb Coyote Ridge with a small clutch of kids and plant one-year-old fir and redwood seedlings in the shelter of shadowy north-facing canyons. From here, the willows down in the creek float in a copper haze against the steel-blue coastal range, and the sea and fields are one dark wash of green. When we finally come down from the headlands, we are cold and mean with hunger. We raid the winter garden for abandoned vegetables to make into soup. The forgotten rhubarb chard is still quite tender, its roots running in blood-red and tangled underground. At the back of the field, the rain-beaten remnants of my favorite leeks are still wearing clean white silk stockings under their mud-spattered wrapping leaves. We carry our treasures to the Zen Center kitchen and sauté the leeks with red garlic and cook the chard with tender yellow-flecked potatoes in a rich vegetable stock. Next, we puree the steaming winter vegetables into a thick, hearty soup and feast on the bounty of winter. The kids eagerly slurp down every last drop of soup, cleaning their bowls with slabs of freshly baked Norwegian rye bread spread with sweet butter. It's almost dark when we finish this winter feast. We have worked hard, and the headlands are anchored by more than a few hundred new trees this evening. As night falls outside the cold windows, I remember hidden treasure. Reaching into my coat pocket, I pull out a bright green bouquet of fir tips, collected that afternoon from young Douglas firs that we planted two seasons ago. Delight ripples through the throng, a fresh reason to stay together. Water is boiled and the fir tips are tossed into a teapot to steep, for 2 minutes only, into fragrant forest tea, rich in vitamin C. Chocolate chip cookies materialize as if by magic from the locked cookie cabinet that only 13-year-old Davy knows how to open with an unfaltering sleight of hand. Everyone looks the other way as Davy opens the forbidden door. Triumphant, he serves us cookies, while Elisa helps Sabrina pour hot fir-tip tea. We lift our steaming cups to the cold night and warm company. "Love winter," wrote Thomas Merton, "when the plants say nothing, and all the links that bind us to one another, to real food and the sleeping land, are alive and intertwined." Thanks for being with me. Enjoy our coming winter. Let's all cuddle up and drink fir-tip tea if we can find it. See you next time. This is Nancy Williams.